dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Okay, Swinona, this would be a science show today.
A science show.
We're with Chris Lunn, or we could call him Chris the Science Guy. What is an American antelope?
What's an American antelope? Yeah. Pronghorn antelope?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have the American pronghorn. And, okay, one thing you have to know about the history of how animals were named is settlers came across the country with their wagons and whatnot, and they named things according to what they knew from the old world. You know, buffalo are not buffalo, they're bison. But an antelope are not antelope, they're pronghorn, and they're a completely separate species from they're not an antelope. They're their own lineage of a Pleistocene animal, that hooved animal, herbivore, that evolved. It's a classic case of coevolution, where like two animals have the same traits or the same coloration or the same methods of getting away from predators, where the pronghorn antelope depends on its vision to see predators. It doesn't like going near brushy areas where a predator could ambush it easily. It stays out on the plains and watches. It also has a two-tone coloration to its body, and that breaks up its form at a distance. From a great distance, it doesn't look like a solid animal, just like airplanes in World War II were painted light colored on the bottom and dark on the top to break up on the horizon.
But its predator was what?
But yeah, and now I'm getting to that. Then you have the Thompson's gazelle, you know, or the impala antelope of Africa, and they're colored the same, and they, you know, they kind of occupy the same niche in the ecosystem, and they're very fast, and they spot their predators with their eyes most of the time. They can smell them too, but their great advantage is they stay out in the open. They don't go into cover, and they spot the predator. And you have to ask, what was the predator? Because there is no predator for the American antelope or the American pronghorn. There's no predator. There's no predator. Wolves really can't catch them. Coyotes can catch their fawns. Golden eagles prey on their fawns. But there's no predator that they have this symbiosis with, where there's always for the moose in the North Woods, it's the wolf, you know. And for the elk in the Rocky Mountains, it's the reintroduced wolf. There's a predator-prey relationship. There's no real predator-prey relationship left for the pronghorn. But what we know is that there was an American cheetah that existed, that died out 10,000 years ago. And the natural history of the pronghorn antelope, they had the relationship with this cheetah, just like the antelope still do in Africa, and that's why it has such striking similarities to the African species. Although it has no relation whatsoever, it was just chased by the same predator, and it needed the same tools to survive. So it has incredible eyesight, similar coloration. What works for the African antelope works for the pronghorn antelope to stay ahead of the same predator, the American cheetah. We also had an American lion too, that's documented in the La Brea tar pits in California.
And wasn't the horse here? You know what you're talking
about? Yeah, and then there was the horse originated in the Americas, as did the camel species.
Camel species?
Yes, the camel species and the horses originated on the plains of America, of North America. And they traveled across the land bridge into Asia. There's camel remains. There's camel skeletons in the La Brea tar pits in California. There are a lot of species that are completely gone, too. But so the horse and the camel traveled across the land bridge into Eurasia, into the Siberian steppes and of Russia and into Europe and Mongolia and China, and then they died out in the Americas. Both the camel and the horse died out in the Americas. We have cousins of the camel, the alpaca and llama down in South America. So that's a species that originated here and moved to Eurasia and then died out here completely. And then, interestingly enough, of course, the horse was returned to the Americas by the Spanish as they came to conquer everything.
Okay, I want to talk to you about biology, conservation, and extinction. You are someone who has spent a lot of time observing nature. I have to say, more than most native people that I know, got a pretty wide knowledge of behavior of birds that I never heard anything like. The descriptions that I heard from you, very, very interesting. I mean, we live up in northern Minnesota, and there are birds everywhere, and we watch them, but I couldn't name all them birds. All those birds, they're pretty cool. Sometimes we just name them an Ojibwe, but, noticing how, what did you tell me yesterday? How a sandpiper makes a nest. You said there's like a dance between the male and female, or is it?
Oh, we were talking about sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. We have about five different species of grouse in Montana, and a lot of bird species use coloration, posturing, all kinds of different ways to distinguish the species to the opposite sex. And they say that, well, these birds of our prairie regions and woodlands too, they have elaborate dances and displays that are uniquely belong to that species. And the calls and the sounds and the movements of their feet distinguish them. And the areas where they dance, the dancing grounds are called leks. For the sage grouse, they're pretty much set in stone. For the sharp tail, they return every year, but they can change a little bit in location. It's a place where the birds come from. Kind of I would say like the sage country is vast and nondescript, and the birds need a place to gather. And in their heads, they have, the leks are ancestral. Like they, the chicks that that are born from the mating activities on these leks return to these leks and carry on the generation.
Can you tell me a little bit about the great blue heron nest making special ritual? It's pretty damn interesting because I never watched it. We have a lot of great blue herons up on our lakes in northern Minnesota.
Okay, so great blue heron nests in what are called rookeries. And these rookeries could be really tall trees with, you know, nests scattered through the tops of the branches, and they have protection from predators by nesting so high up. Then the rookeries that we have in Montana are the same for the most part along river routes, river riparian zones, and but there's a rookery that I know of that's relatively low, not so high up in the trees. It's in willow bushes, but the key is that it's in a flooded swamp, so the ground predators are pretty limited that could access the nest. So they're not concerned with great height. They're kind of low to the water surface. So I can observe them really well from the water. And what I see is that the female kind of tends to the nests and tends to the chicks when they hatch. The male blue heron goes out to forage in the lakes, and especially the trout streams. You'll see them flying, like, you know, for miles to go get food. But part of the bond building that they do is the male brings back a stick that he finds. Very often, like every hour, he brings back a stick. It's not about the chicks are hatched; they're already active in the nest, you know, begging for food. And the male brings back a stick in its bill. It hands it off to the female, and there's this whole ritual dance and posturing and kind of bowing movement. And they spread their wings, and the female takes the stick very carefully from the male's bill. The eyes of the bird are so important for survival that there's a shield, like in similar in reptiles, that covers their eyes for protection when at the instant that they hand off the stick. I noticed that the males always, just about always, cover their eyes. Like you see in the photographs that I take, the male's eyes are like a bluish, opaque, unclear from this extra eyelid that covers their eyes. They can still see through it, but in case the female accidentally pokes them in the eye, they have some protection. And the female usually doesn't bother covering her eyes. She just picks the stick up from the male and then carefully places it in the nest. And then again, he leaves after he delivers the stick to find more sticks or to go and fish and bring back food to regurgitate to the young. But yeah, they have this whole ritual where they hand off a stick. And it's a bond building thing. There's so many things that I see when I'm out there that are strikingly. I don't want to be anthropomorphic about it. I don't want to compare them, and I don't want to make them into Disney cartoon characters. But there's so many things that I observe that are so similar to our own biology as humans. And I think we as humans put ourselves on a pedestal above the animals, and no longer, you know, do people, you know, take careful observations of animals, but when you watch animals very carefully within their own private, you know, realm, you'll see so many striking similarities to what we do, you know, as humans. We provide, as long as we're providing for our mate, you know, things are
good in the nest.
Good in the nest, yeah. Good at home, you know. Same thing with the blue heron. Obviously, the female probably selects the male. There's probably something in the behavior.
She's hoping for a skillful guy.
Yeah, she's looking for a skillful nest builder and a provider for the chicks. And I think that
are there any couch potatoes in the heron population?
I don't know. There could be, but
they aren't surviving. Probably they aren't breeding.
I think the whole like ritual of bringing the stick begins that process of selecting a mate. You know, successful delivery of the stick, handing off, all that kind of stuff. Says that this mate is right for you know, providing and bringing food back as well as sticks for the nest, and the nests get bigger and bigger every year. Yeah,
that's so it's a multi-year nest.
Yeah, they use them every year. Yeah, they're platforms, and they build on the you know, on the old nest every year until they're just big jumbled piles of sticks stuck in the tree,
well tree orchestrated branches. According to how you look at it. Yeah. You could call it jumbo. Okay. So I just want to say, you know, I'm talking to Chris Lennon. You have a bunch of photographs that are online. Is that right?
Yeah, there's, you know, I have some on the albums on the Facebook, and I got some on Smug Mug, which is just a public display board for photographs.
But you have been observing birds for a pretty long time. I think you observe a lot of things from what I gather. I've talked to you about antelope, but I've talked to you about elk and deer. But you have an interesting approach because you have a special camouflage and you can get really close. Yeah. And without divulging all the secrets.
Well, I don't mind divulging the secrets.
Tell a little story. It's kind of interesting because it's like a floating muskrat house. Is that correct?
Yeah. We've got developed a way to slip around in the marshes to do my photography and observation of waterfowl. We've got a blind that uses a truck inner tube, a hula hoop type of PVC plastic pipe that I just bend in a hoop and then secure it. And then struts for support are half inch PVC, and everything's attached with the strappings I'll scrap an old inner tube and cut long strips, kind of like leather thongs, and then, you know, attach everything, wind the rubber around the plastic. I found this is the best way because gluing doesn't really hold up in water when it gets wet. Any kind of nail or screws, you know, can pop the inner tube.
So you create this thing so that you can see, and your photos are really close.
Yeah, the whole idea is to get super close to the birds. You know, when I was 15, you know, I would set up these. I had no idea concept of this floating blind, this mobile blind, and I would set up, you know, like a what looked like a duck blind, typical duck blind that you'd shoot out of, but I'd use it for photography, but it was incredibly limited because you're waiting there for birds to land near the blind. But with this mobile blind, you can spot a flock of, you know, pintails or canvasbacks or gadwalls that have just landed, and then you can slowly, you know, move in on them with the muskrat lodge blind.
And I know that, you know, I was talking to you about, like, our powwows. We got a lot of dance moves that come from the prairie chicken dance that's out there, but a lot of bird activities or showing off for their females or making it sound in the nest, a lot of that traditional dancer moves come from a lot of these birds that you can observe firsthand with or without the floating muskrat house.
Yeah, when you go look at the sharptail and the sage grouse in Montana, the best blind to use is just a plywood box. A plywood box with windows that open and close for the camera. And I found that if you can put the plywood box up and leave it for a couple of days, the birds completely ignore it. There's a lot of structures out on the prairie left by man, like, you know, feeding troughs for cattle or whatever. So the birds aren't that shocked if they see something that appears, as long as they have time to get used to it. So you sit in the blind. The sage grouse, they walk in carefully to the lek. They'll walk in through the sagebrush. You can see them coming in. And the area where they dance is usually, it could be 100 years old, and it's completely, there's not much brush or there's no sagebrush out there to block their vision of each other. It's usually like a little football field, like a super smooth, you know, AstroTurf, you know, type of setting.
Like a dance arbor.
Yeah, like a dance arbor, exactly. And surrounded by a ring of sagebrush. And so they all gather here. There could be 75, 80 birds. They'll arrive usually about 8 o'clock in the evening, and then they'll stay there all night. And if it's a full moon and there's light, they'll dance, and you can just hear this, you know, popping and drumming sound all night long. And it's interesting because if cloud cover comes over and blocks the moon, they all get super quiet and they settle down for a while. And the clouds, you know, can cover for 20 minutes or a half an hour, an hour. And as soon as the cloud clears away and the moon comes out again, they go to dancing again, and the sound, you know, turns up in volume, and it's really incredible to hear, like, you know, 80 birds with basically built-in, they have air sacs that make the sound. They breathe in, they open their bills, and they suck in the air, and then they puff up their chest, and it's kind of a, if I can imitate it, it's like a dunk-a-dunk, 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 dunk-a-dunk. And there's another sound that's interesting. That's from their wings. Their wings, as they push up their chest, kind of make a interesting, like, shh, shh. So you got this shh, dunk a dunk, shh, dunk a dunk, you know. And then you times that by 80, and it's like 80 little drummers out there going at once. It sounds like, you know, water boiling or something. It's like crazy. And so they're affected by light, And then by the when the morning comes and the sun begins to rise, that's when it really takes off. And the beautiful sunlight comes over and bathes the prairie grass and in orange and that nice orange light morning. It's great to watch the birds, great photography. And about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, when the sun's just starting to get kind of a white, stronger look to it, they kind of slow down, they wind down, and then they start to leave the lek, and they'll just flush off the lek and leave. And if a predator comes over, like a golden eagle, which is probably their main predator, the most dangerous predator to them, they will absolutely flatten out and make kind of they definitely have a call that they can communicate that there's a problem, that there's a predator, that they spotted a predator, and it's kind of a clicking of their bill and a grunting, clicking of their bill, and then they all like flatten, and they have colors that show up when they want to display, like they have a white color, and they absolutely cover that white. They have a white chest, and they crouch down low and flatten themselves on the prairie so that you can't see the white, and all you see is the drab, mottled, striped back color of their feathers, and their tail feathers are kind of brown and striped, like a pheasant, but not exactly. So they can blend in a second with their surroundings if there's a golden eagle flying around.
So this is the camouflage that they do?
Yeah, this is their protective color.
Okay, so one of the reasons I was interested in asking about this is that, I mean, most of us are pretty disconnected right now. I got all electronic stuff everybody else has. We cruise by in our cars. Not a lot of people take the trouble to stop and lay in a field in a blind and take photos for hours with these guys. But what I know is that our ancestors did.
Sure. Yeah.
And a lot of our ancestors did. I mean, some people's ancestors killed a lot of them, and some people's ancestors observed a lot of them, and some people's ancestors worked it out, and they ate some, and then they watched some, right, and they honored them in their dances, and honored them, you know, in their ceremonies, you know, because that's who we are as indigenous people. And I don't know a lot about all of this ecosystem here, but, you know, I was visiting, and I was in Michigan a couple of months ago, and someone was talking about wild rice, and there was a big forum on wild rice, and they asked me to talk there, and I was talking there, and I was listening to them, and they used to have wild rice, but they don't have wild rice in most of Michigan anymore. They lost all their wild rice because of industrialization and overdevelopment and sulfates in the water and PCBs and people calling it a lake weed and dredging their lakes until they have no more of what the Ojibwe consider the sacred grain. But this woman that was there, and she talked about this phrase, which was ecological amnesia. She said that they had developed ecological amnesia. And I think that it might be true that a lot of Americans have developed ecological amnesia. We forget how beautiful things are or how beautiful things were, right?
Yeah, and I definitely have something to say about that. I think that what we have today, what we have left today, are the tiny like remnants of what there was. We're looking, you know, they call this the fifth extinction. Oh, I'm sorry, the sixth extinction. The fifth extinction was the extinction of the dinosaurs, you know, which they think was caused by a meteorite. And this is the sixth extinction, and it's caused by man, by humanity. And what we know, what we think is normal, like the new norm, as they say, is with wildlife populations, highly managed wildlife populations, and, you know, duck species is the dwindling remnant of what was when the country was colonized or settled. We've lost, you know,
You're talking about settled, colonized by
colonized by Europeans.
Okay, you gave me an example. I mean, we were talking yesterday that there was like 50 million buffalo in the place, the largest migratory herd in the world.
Yeah, we've lost the buffalo is extinct in the wild. Yeah, there's a remnant population in Yellowstone hemmed in and highly managed by, you know, horseback cowboys and helicopters and
Montana Department of Livestock.
Right, you know, and that's what I'm saying. That's the last, the largest remnant, and that's what we're looking at.
And that determined a whole ecosystem, because the buffalo,
they're a keystone species.
Well, it's not just that they're a charismatic megafauna. They're like the big guys, so we think of them, but they also determined the ecosystem by their movement, and they thundered, they stimulated water, they changed growth, they moved back aspen through browsing. Mm. They are part of an ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
That is now heavily damaged, the most damaged ecosystem perhaps in the country, right?
Yeah. In 1889, there in out of Fort Benton. Fort Benton was a hub of exporting the fauna of the Great Plains, particularly the Northern Great Plains. Thousands of buffalo hides and tongues were sent down the river on steamboats. What was also sent down there's a record, and it's purely for business. It has nothing to do with, they weren't thinking conservation. They weren't thinking, in the records of the traders, 30,000 wolf pelts were sent out in 1 year in 1889. That now we have 700 wolves, and we're calling that the carrying capacity. The carrying capacity of the state of Montana is only 700 wolves. 30,000 wolf pelts were sent out in 1 year. That shows what the bison were capable of supporting. And in some of that, there's the population of wolves obviously escalated with the killing of the buffalo, and there were so many carcasses laying around. But that's just one year. In the Lewis and Clark journals, you know, at some points they were never out of sight of bison, and it was nothing to see a pack of 30 wolves trailing a small band of bison, and they saw the wolves, you know, hunting. It was the Serengeti. We've lost that richness for, we have traded it for farming, for agriculture.
And actually largely unsustainable, hauling, you know, dragging water up from the dwindling supply in the Oglala Aquifer, using a lot of chemicals, and then putting an animal out there that 100,000 of them die in a freak September blizzard, right?
Yeah, we replaced the Great Plains. The bison is uniquely adapted for the Great Plains, for the harshness of it. I've heard some people compare them to camels in the way they can store water, and they don't need... Cattle need constant water availability. They need to be close to water because they are a non-native species, and their roots come from European wild cattle of the mountains. And one interesting fact that goes back to the sage grouse is they've put so many reservoirs. They've dug. There's a large area in Montana. I would call it, you know, semi-wilderness, but it's not forests and trees and mountains. It's plains of sagebrush, and it's called the Charlie Marion Russell National Wildlife Refuge. It borders both sides of the Fort Peck Reservoir and the Missouri River breaks. So it has probably the most stable and largest population of sage grouse in the state. And it has no buffalo. There's about 500,000 acres involved in the refuge itself, and then a lot of other BLM land that adds up to a lot more acreage. But there's no buffalo in the refuge except for some little private herds, and the place is pretty much a livestock permitted area. Yeah, I mean, a wildlife refuge that supports herds of cattle. And one of the funniest things about this is you drive the loop road, you know, as an observer, and there's areas where you can, you know, view wildlife just like Yellowstone Park, and there'll be like a placard of a silhouette of an elk saying this is a good place to pull over and watch elk. Then 10 or a mile later, there'll be a placard of Canadian geese. This is a good place to observe waterfowl. Then up on there's a big flat area where there's a grassy area, and there's actually a placard of a beef cow. Like you want to stop and, you know,
we look have a cow.
Yeah, you want to. You've just come up here through the tens of thousands of herds of pastured Angus cows, and you've come here to look at a cow. So the place, this is probably the best place for the reintroduction of plains bison in the West. Period. It'll probably happen, and hopefully it happens in my lifetime. But the forces that are against it are so ingrained. There's in Montana, I would say there's a culture of fear of three things. There is a fear of amongst the ranching community, colonizers, families that have been here. They talk about how they've been here for so long, and they've been here for 100 years. So the three things are bison, wolves, and Native American, because they rolled those forces back, you know, 150 years ago, 125 years ago, and they in their way of thinking that was progress, as they opened up the land for cattle, they opened up the land for agriculture, and by God, the return of the bison to the CMR is just a sign that things are just going down the drain for those communities. Prairie dogs is another keystone species that they do not want to see come back.
It's like a psychological fear that's become a societal deep, and deep. Public policy fear. I mean, it's interesting because I would say, like, it is not that different, for instance, perhaps in Minnesota, you know, where wolves and Indians and Anishinaabe prophecies that said that the Anishinaabe and the wolf would walk side by side, and what would befall the wolf would befall the Anishinaabe.
Right.
And so, you know, when we are all cut down, they're all cut down, and then now they're coming back in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and then they delist them off the endangered species list for the same thing, cut down, you know, cut down their numbers. It is very indicative, in a way, of a story that is told and retold. I want to ask you to shift a little bit. You know, you're a biologist by some training, but you're more a biologist, in my limited experience with you, by just dead-on observation and a lot of hours in the field and thinking about it. But I wanted to ask you why extinction matters. And I wanted to ask you, you know, we talked a little bit before about how many buffalo there were and how they were an ecosystem. You know, how they were so, you know, essential to the same ecosystem we're fighting over for the KXL pipeline, the same ecosystem we're fighting over for what we're going to do for food, you know, and feedlot cattles and all of this today. You know, very, very much contested terrain still, spiritually, in terms of markets, in terms of economics, in terms of culture and way of life. I mean, everything changes all the time. But, you know, so the largest migratory herd in the world is blown off by guns to settle the prairie and to diminish and to get control of the native people, because that was what they did. Right, that's what Philip Sheridan said. Is you know you can't fight
destroy the commissary of the Indians.
Destroy their commissary and you will control them. Right? And so you know then today we have the highest rates of diabetes and we're enclosed in these reservations and you know inside them we don't even have control. But so that was a huge herd. A lot of us don't think about, if you want to talk about ecological amnesia, that 150 years ago or 100 years ago, probably 150 years ago, there was a flock. And that flock was passenger pigeons, right?
Right.
What did you tell me yesterday? Remind me what you said. You already say 40%, right?
40% of the biomass of bird species in the North American continent was one species, and that was the passenger pigeon. They called it the feathered river because these flocks of birds numbered in the billions. Not the millions, the billions. And they would, you know, these settlers reported flocks of these birds starting in the morning, and they would see them in the morning, spreading across the sky in a column that blotted out the sun. And when you say that, it sounds like an exaggeration. But when after I read these different accounts of witnesses, one common thing always comes up, that the sky was dark with these birds, that the sun was blotted out. There were so many birds, and they would stream across the sky in a great column, and the flocks could last from morning till sundown, and only at sundown would you start to see the great flock was starting to dwindle in numbers, and patches of sky would appear. You know, so, you have to, and also the roar of the sound of the wings too was deafening. And these birds are completely gone, just completely wiped out. Another keystone species that was whenever a wildlife species becomes marketed, that's kind of like the stamp of doom. And the bison was marketed and the passenger pigeon was marketed, sold in the markets in New York to the populations and salted in barrels of salted bird carcasses. And the railroad played a great role in the destruction of the bison. The railroad also played a great role in the destruction of the passenger pigeons. And part of the reason why some of the railroads were put into certain areas was to move passenger pigeons to market. That's how prolific the hunting was and the all-out slaughter. Go ahead.
So in the Anishinaabe community, there is, north of the Grand Portage Reservation, there's the Pigeon River. And what I was figuring is like, that wasn't there talking about pigeons you see in the city today.
Well, they're talking about wild pigeons.
They're talking about those pigeons.
The passenger pigeon was about two-thirds larger than what we know as the mourning dove. And the mourning dove, they look similar, but the passenger pigeon had kind of a auburn, reddish breast, like a robin. Some of the biggest flocks in Minnesota were reported living near the Mississippi River in that bluff region between Wabasha and Winona, Minnesota. And those were some of the last flocks, probably where they were destroyed. Probably in the 1860s, and marketed out.
And we also have some names. There's pigeon people whose last name is Pigeon,
right?
Or white pigeon in our communities. And I think about that because Omimi is our word for pigeon. And it doesn't, there's no reason that we would have that except for to talk about these wild pigeons. And so, you know, I'm kind of getting back to this idea of this historical amnesia and how it no longer makes sense. Like, I mean, you have these names and you're like, where did that come from? Or these places? But they, you know, it is this great loss that exists ecologically. It's a great loss that exists, I think, someplace, I know, in the psyche of a lot of Native people, in our genetic memory. We remember these things. I mean, in our case, the sturgeon is another one in our area, which our community has been working really hard to bring back. But some of these guys you can't bring back because there's no more of them. Yeah, like the passenger pigeon, there's no more of those.
No resurrecting them from the dead.
Why does it matter? I mean, we talked about the great extinctions, and like, I know it matters spiritually. I don't believe that we have a right to kill something that the Creator put here.
Well, I think that as the extinctions accelerate, which they are around the world, according to scientists, and more animals become threatened, you know, in the rainforests, and it's pretty common knowledge that the frogs of the world are in great danger. I think it's a red flag. It's a warning sign to Homo sapiens that we're pushing the you know, our boundaries too much, and it's going to be a question of, honestly, greed versus the choice of our longevity, our survival, you know, into the next century.
Okay, and in this case, though, you're making this to be like about us, and it is about us. I mean, we're human, obviously.
Well, that's the argument that you'd have to go to the industrialists with. You know, a person like me just feels, you know, incredible sadness and loss thinking about that another generation was willingly ignorant enough to destroy billions of birds in a frenzy. There is something that's common in, like, in the human nature in history. You know, I don't know if you can tag it on Europeans or when there's a great abundance and there's the means to destroy that abundance, there always is reports of, like, frenzy killing. They can't stop themselves. They would kill passenger pigeons and have no way to get them to market. You know, many of the great killings that were reported went either into hog feed or rotted. You know, there was no practicality to it. But to get back to what I was saying, you have to take an argument that makes sense to people that think in like a short-term gain, prestige. You have to have them see that we're not going to be around. If they don't care about animals, maybe they would care about the existence of people, because that's pretty common throughout, you know, that's pretty easy to understand that this is about our own species and we're all connected. And as you know, animals become more threatened and the environment becomes more hostile and polluted, we threaten our own existence. You know, we don't eat rocks and we don't eat things from other planets. If the ecology collapses, so do we. We will go out with these species of animals in the end.
So I want to say a couple things to that, listening to you. And one is that, you know, in our area, our tribes have been fighting the delisting of the wolf from the endangered species.
Yeah.
And so all of the Minnesota Chippewa tribes and the Red Lake have declared wolf sanctuaries inside their territories. And it is crossing into Glyphwick area, Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife, the whole northern region, because the place where the wolves are is where the Ojibwes are.
Right.
And yet the state of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan is not yet respecting our jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's this push in the tribal communities to create, there's this discussion, I'll put it this way, which seems like an enlightened discussion to me, to have tribal endangered species acts, having tribes take jurisdiction, and on one hand, you know, over whether it is a plant or whether it is a animal or whether it is a bird, and to say that we value these because these are part of our life, mm-hmm. and we understand them. And on one hand, I realize that, you know, we have been reduced to islands. Crow territory is no longer 8 million acres.
Right.
You know, it is crow territory, but it is not treated as such.
Yeah.
Right? And it is the same thing, you know, at home. 17 million acres of northern Minnesota is within our treaty boundaries, mm-hmm. you know, but it's not. So to me, you know, one of the things of having agency at this point in our lives, or, you know, being indigenous people who are thoughtful, who are resonant with not only our cultural and spiritual teachings, but also with how that is reflected in the biological and the natural world. You know, this restoration, I think, is a really interesting idea.
Yes, and I'll speak to that, in that that should not be undervalued. That is a very important vision. I'll tell you in brief the story of a bird that pretty much the extinction of can be laid on one piece of land, on one corporation. There was a bird, an iconic bird of the Mid-South and South that lived in the Mississippi River drainage. And that bird was the ivory-billed woodpecker. The ivory-billed woodpecker lost its grip when the timber companies cleared the land. And also, you know, cotton played a big role. Cotton of the South, you clear the land for fields, and the big open cotton fields are not the habitat of ivory-billed woodpeckers.
Yeah, I mean, so basically woodpeckers need big trees.
Woodpeckers need big, deep swamps and trees, big old-growth trees. They feed in the tops. They were a specialist that fed on beetle grubs that were in the very tippy top, you know, branches of these old growth trees. As these old growth trees began to die, they were infested with these beetle grubs that would drill holes in the trees and eat the tree from top to bottom.
So this is, I mean, I just want one more time to say this is like a specialist thing.
Yeah, this is a specialist bird,
which is part of what biodiversity is about. Is a lot of specialists.
Yes, there's specialist birds or specialist mammals, and then there's birds and mammals that.
Omnivores.
Well, omnivores, but yeah, they're generalists.
Like a bear.
A raccoon is a great example of a generalist, and that's why they're so common everywhere. I have healthy populations of raccoons out in the ponds and the swamps in my backyard, and we had them in Illinois where I grew up, in Minnesota. They're everywhere because they're a generalist. An ivory-billed woodpecker is the opposite of that. He's a specialist. He feeds on one or two kinds of beetles that infest the top branches of these old-growth trees. Now, the point of me talking about this is that it came down to one tract of land called the Singer Tract. It was called the Singer Tract because it belonged to the Singer Sewing Machine Corporation or company. There was specialists, there were ornithologists that were aware of the Singer Tract. There was, you know, several nesting sites of the ivory. This was the last stronghold of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And it was in Louisiana. And they sent specialists down, and they got the only film of the ivory-billed woodpecker that exists, the only moving picture of the ivory-billed woodpecker returning to its nest and, you know, kind of positioning itself around the nest and feeding its young. When the Cornell University, the ornithologist from Cornell, appealed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt because he was a bird watcher and he might have some sympathy, but it was around the war time, so America was all caught up in the war effort. And Franklin or Roosevelt didn't move quick enough. He was interested, but he didn't move quick enough. And the word got out to the Singer Sewing Machine Corporation that their tracts of land, their private holdings, held this rare bird. And they told their logger, the loggers that were contracted for cutting the trees. This accelerated the destruction of, almost in spite, just out of greed, they went down there and cut every tree. They leveled the forest, destroying the nesting trees of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And the ornithologist from Cornell said that he saw the last female ivory-billed flying across the clear cuts. Now, there's been reports of ivory-billed since then, but just like real fleeting. They held out in Cuba till the 1980s. There was a student from the University of Louisiana who claimed he saw a pair while turkey hunting, but pretty much they've dwindled to nothing, and they're not sure whether they should call them extinct or not. You know, pretty much they're gone.
So this is like one place where they still were, and if that place had been left alone...
If that place was protected properly, we'd still have ivory-billed woodpeckers today. Almost undoubtedly. There were several nesting pairs in this last stand of old-growth, swampy hardwoods. And that's why I say, like, you know, tracts of land owned by Native people, you know, if they can put in management plans to protect the species that exists there, regardless of federal policy or lobbyists that pay politicians to keep things as they are and keep polluting and destroying, you know, the coastlines and the environments and the marshlands. You know, so Native peoples being sovereign nations can do, I think there's a great importance and significance in the protection of the tribal lands for, you know, species that today may seem common, but, you know, in the future, you know, they may be the next ivory bill.
Chris Lyon, you have some poetry about the passenger pigeon. Can you share that with me?
Sure. I think that one of the greatest expressions of humanity is poetry. And so I'm going to read a poem on the passenger pigeon. I'm going to read this intro to the poem so you know who wrote it. Amos Butler ended his article on the passenger pigeon in his Birds of Indiana, 1897, with these words. Their passing away must fill the soul of everyone into whose life their migration have come as an experience with profound regret. I introduce the lines of a careful observer, a faithful interpreter of nature, my friend Hon B. S. Parker. His Hoosier birds are the feathered songsters of our beloved state, and therein he has preserved his recollections of the passenger pigeons. And windy tumults shake the ground, and the trees break down with feathered ones store, and many swiftly pulsing wings are spread at once in sudden fright, till every fleeting minute brings the noise of some delirious flight, and all the air is dark with swarms of pigeons in their quest for food, while autumn leaves in eddying storms are beaten by the feathered flood. In olden times there were pigeons. We saw them fly in springtime, in small flocks and charming large ones. What a great pleasure it was. The boys in the fields, a plowing, would stop with their tired teams and full in voice call pigeons, you heavenly beautiful creatures. And they flew away over the mountains high, still high over deep valleys. So we, with joy, just let them fly. We thought to ourselves, you may decide. We hear guns cracking here and there, rusty iron, long time loaded. The shooting is worth nothing, just noise, damaging the lazy shooters themselves. Still finally, the pigeons, tired from flying, set down with water rushing, in cool shade, consider themselves lucky. There they call, there, and listen. How beautiful they are, sitting in low rows, and in high green trees and branches, with little gray caps and tidy gray coats, with red and white vests. They are now entirely gone, these wild pigeons, eternally never to come back. What yet remains of these beautiful blessings, the spirit lays its treasures down.
Who was that by?
Paul Fleischman, Newbery Medal winner.
And this is, and you got this book you're reading out of called The Feathered...
A Feathered River Across the Sky by Joel Greenberg. I guess he works for the Field Museum.
All right.
Here's another one that's good and short. We were counted not in the thousands nor millions, but in the billions. We were numerous as the stars in the heavens, as grains of sand at the edge of the sea, as the buffalo on the plains. When we burst into flight, we so filled the sky that the sun was darkened and the day became dusk. Humblers of the sun we were. Inconceivable, inconceivable without us. Yet it's 1914, and here I am, alone, caged in the Cincinnati Zoo, the last of the passenger pigeons.
So they say that we caused extinction of more species in the past 150 years and since the Ice Age. And we're watching a lot of that go down now. A lot of challenges, like you're saying. I mean, I talked to you about some turtles. They can't move too fast. They can't adapt. They're already kind of toughing it out. They have to live 100 years because they can't have babies that often because they got to find themselves a mate and they're turtles. Right?
Yeah, the world's turtles are under great stress right now. Various reasons. In the Asian countries, they collect them and sell them in food markets. There's a lot of sea turtles showing up with diseases. Great, like, tumors all over their flippers. The Chelonians, the turtles have existed early in the dinosaur record. They outlived all the catastrophes of the planet. If they don't outlive this this human stress and destruction of the planet, then, you know, that to me, I mean, the disappearance of turtles, the Yangtze River in China is so polluted that they just like the passenger pigeon, they have the last of a certain kind of soft-shell turtle. And it's the individual, they have an individual female that's 100 years old. I think they have a male, and the female is too old to breed. You know, they've got it in a zoo, and they're trying to get it something going with, you know, captive breeding program. But
she says, "I'm done."
Yeah, I'm done. And the habitat's destroyed, you know, at least for now, until they clean up the rivers. But, you know, China's probably like, you know, 40 years behind the U.S. in environmental standards. And as I mentioned yesterday, you know, when I was a kid on the coast, Cape Cod, we never saw young striped bass. We never saw schools of young striped bass. We heard rumors of the large adults being caught out at sea on boats. But as kids around the harbors and in dinghies and stuff, we never saw schools of bass. But then the Clean Water Act came and cleaned up the rivers and stopped companies from, you know, factories and whatnot from discharging waste into the rivers. And the rivers were cleaned up. And now the striped bass is coming back with, you know, like incredible strength and returning to the coast. Just, you know, 10 years ago, I saw there were schoolies, you know, small shoals of young striped bass, like, you know, striped bass that may be like, well, a couple pounds, feeding on the minnows and the menhaden, schools of menhaden right close to shore. We never saw that feature. You know, we never saw that when we were kids, but you can see it now. And you can see it, and they just snap at the surface, and the whole water's boiling where they're feeding, and never saw that as kids. And so that's come back. And so that there's a lot of hope, but yeah, you've got to start acting now. It's a crisis situation.
And I just want to say, because on behalf of like the people of White Earth, we didn't have sturgeon.
Yeah.
They're wiped out in our community. And now we have, I think, the largest sturgeon restoration program in our region.
Yeah.
And we have over 100,000 sturgeon in our lakes. And, you know, hopefully they'll be able to keep coming back. And I know there's some big, tough fish.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you can do something.
Yeah.
But you got to do it before there's none.
Yeah, you have to act before you're talking about Jurassic Park science of bringing DNA out of a mosquito trapped in amber. You know, you got to act while you have the remnant, you know, population there and some of the habitat still intact, and you need to understand what that species needs.
And that's a responsibility of native people, because we're the people that are related to these animals, but it's also the responsibility of everybody who lives here.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like in the conquering, people, I think, like you say, amnesia, you need to realize that North America was conquered, and there was a lot of violence in that, and there was violence on native people, and there's violence on the environment, and violence on animals. And I think that as, you know, we non-natives kind of shed our skin of the old world of exploitation and this promise of abundance and prosperity and wealth, and we start seeing ourselves as belonging to this land. We start to get protective about it like natives were. We start to understand where the perspective of where native peoples were coming from. Like, God forbid any other...
But you're talking about larger than the idea of the national parks. I mean, the national parks were part of that movement. Obviously, Glacier, Yellowstone, Yosemite, or Yosemite, as we actually know it.
Yosemite.
But you're... Because animals don't necessarily fit into... park.
Animals don't recognize boundaries. That's why you have buffaloes, you know, flowing, yeah, migrating out of the park. Yeah, the thing that like, you know, farming, agriculture is absolutely anti-migration. We don't really have any migrating animals except for birds, which, you know, it's all about fencing. It's all about trampling crops. You know, they don't want buffalo returning to a migratory state. Like the only reason that, you know, like caribou in northern Alaska are in great herds of, you know, 300,000, 100,000, is because they're marching across tundra, they're marching across non-agricultural land. So So they were left alone, not out of really conservation, because you know, we couldn't exploit that land. We couldn't figure out how to exploit the northern tundra. And now, of course, we're moving oil rigs and stuff. There's a way. There's some wealth to get out of there. And
Reed is quite resourceful.
Right, right. But and down here on the wheat field, you know, plains of Montana, we have fencing, we have highways, we have infrastructure, we have railroads, we have towns. And there's no, it's very difficult for us to wrap our minds around making room for an animal as big as the bison. I've actually heard of a senator from Montana saying that the buffalo has seen its day. The buffalo is the woolly mammoth. We just need to forget about it. And that's incredibly sad. And that I just hope that mindset is in the minority. And I think it is, but they call it the shaggy tank. You know, the rancher calls it the shaggy tank because it bulldozes through the fences.
But as a perfect example of in the time of climate change questions, when there was a freak storm that took out 100,000 cattle in South Dakota,
mm-hmm.
I believe that one of your friends went to see some bison.
There was a cattle rancher that, you know, flipped over and went to bison because he saw the ecological, you know, sense in it. And make a long story short, we had a unprecedented, you know, 100-year storm that wiped out, you know, thousands and thousands of cattle across Dakota and parts of Montana. Well, mainly in Dakota. And a friend of mine who brain tans buffalo hides, makes them into robes, he visited he gets his hides from this buffalo rancher, and they didn't lose, you know, one single buffalo. And he says that there was no real cover for the bison. You know, this is just, you know, this is what they're used to. This is what they've been built for. A big difference between cattle and bison is that cattle do not dig through the snow. That's why they starve to death in conditions like that. And buffalo, you know, with their massive heads and their paw and their hooves, they, you know, easily break through the snow layer and get down to the grass. And so that's a
big difference. Okay, thanks again, Christopher Lund. Have a good day, Magooch.
True.